This is the 2015 Rogue River Bible School. This is day five. The first period speaker is Brother Roger Lewis. His class subject is the House of Asaph, Family of Faith, Masters of Music. His class title for today is The Secret of the House of Asaph. Brother Roger.
Well, thank you, Brother Chairman, and good morning on this final morning, my dear brothers and sisters. In our Lord Jesus Christ, as we assemble now on our closing day to gather our thoughts together for each of the studies that have been woven into the fabric of this particular Bible school together around our Heavenly Father's precious word. You might remember that in our last study, we covered the period from Hezekiah through to the return in the days of Zerubbabel. And in fact, we left the sons of Asaph on that occasion in BC 536, on the barren hill of Moriah, singing with all their hearts. They sang over just a few stones, and yet they sang with the same fervor as their family had sung at the dedication of Solomon's magnificent temple so many generations earlier. They knew their courses, they knew their words, they knew their songs. This was 85 years after Josiah's great Passover, and 460 years after David had given this psalm to their family. And perhaps one of the lessons you remember that we learned from that particular study was the principle of the virtue of constancy, that when we're singing, when we're expressing eternal truths before our Heavenly Father, there is no need to change. And this family, the house of Asaph, used the same instruments to sing the same words to the same tune from the same hymn book for over 500 years. They never found it old-fashioned, and they never found it boring. They were hymns of eternal truth, and they were guarded by this family for that reason. Well, that brings us to the story this morning of Nehemiah chapter 12 and to the matter of the dedication of the wall in Nehemiah's time. And we read this in Nehemiah chapter 12 and verse 27. The record says, "And at the dedication of the wall of Jerusalem, they sought the Levites out of all their places to bring them to Jerusalem to keep the dedication with gladness, both with thanksgivings and with singing." Ah, with singing. They wanted to dedicate the wall with singing, it says. And the they that wanted to do that, of course, was in measure Nehemiah himself. Nehemiah, the man who had initiated this building of the wall. Now, the interesting thing you see is that all the great reformers that the nation had ever seen or known always linked their work of reformation to the worship of the Father in heaven. It was all done for the guarding of Yahweh's honor. It was all done for the glory of the Father's name. It was all done for the advancing of the Father's purpose. And every reformation that ever took place always had that idea of the supremacy of God in mind, that God would be exalted in all these things. And Nehemiah, as a reformer, was no different to those that had gone before him. He said, "I might only be building the wall, but this is a moment of spiritual revival. So I need the singers. I need the house of Asaph here." And call them he did. And we know that must be the case, because see what the verse says? It says they were to do it with thanksgiving and with singings and with cymbals and psalteries and with harps. You know, there's something interesting about that, because do you notice this? Do you remember it? We were told in the first of Chronicles in chapter 25 that when the 24 courses of singers were brought together, that it says they were all under the hand of their father, Asaph, for song in the house of Yahweh, with, and it specifically says, with cymbals and psalteries and harps. First of Chronicles chapter 25. But in the day of the dedication of the temple in Solomon's time, in 2 Chronicles chapter 5 and verse 12, we're expressly told the Levites, the singers, all those of Asaph and their brethren, they were arrayed in white linen, having cymbals and psalteries and harps. And when we come to the time of Hezekiah and to the reformation that he launched in the 2 Chronicles chapter 29, it says he set the Levites in the house of Yahweh with cymbals and with psalteries and with harps. And now Nehemiah is going to bring them to the wall in Nehemiah chapter 12, and they're going to bring the singers out, and they're going to do so with cymbals and psalteries and harps. And we suddenly realize that these were the only sacred instruments ever used in the house of God. They never deviated from those instruments. No other instruments have been added, no other types of instruments have been added for 500 years. There was something special about the music of the sanctuary and the songs of Yahweh in that house. Those instruments were guarded. They were precious, and they were never to be changed. And that's part of the spirit of the house of Asaph, of course, is that whenever they come forward with that sense of guarding the past and treasuring the old. Well, the record says, verse 28, that the sons of the singers gathered themselves together, both out of the plain country round about Jerusalem and from the villages of Netophathi, from the house of Gilgal, out of the fields of Geba and Asmaveth, for the singers had builded them villages round about Jerusalem. Well, we wouldn't be surprised, would we, that that's where the singers had built their villages. You see, they belonged to the sanctuary. Their heart was in the sanctuary. Where else would they build villages but clustered tightly around Jerusalem, where their lives, where their very existence was orientated? Oh yes, that's where the villages of the singers were, and out of those villages they came. At the call of Nehemiah, we need this song upon the wall this day. And verse 30 says, the priests and the Levites purified themselves and purified the people and purified the gates and purified the wall. And when all was ready, Nehemiah set the procession in order. And so he says in verse 31, he brought up the princes of Judah upon the wall, and he appointed two great companies. And one of those companies, the record says in verse 31, would go on the right hand upon the wall toward the dung gate, and after them went Hoshea and half of the princes of Judah and Azariah and Ezra and Meshullam, and now we have the list of all those that will go on that side. And then verse 38 will tell us, and the other company of them that gave thanks went over against them, and I after them, and they travelled in the opposite direction along the wall that had now been built and absolutely completed, being joined together so that they could literally walk around the walls of Jerusalem in fulfillment of the spirit of Psalm 48. Now that first group that left off in verse 31 to head in a certain direction, in the middle of that, the record says this in verse 35, that the key to the leadership of all this on this day was this. And certain of the priests' sons with trumpets, namely Zechariah, the son of Jonathan, the son of Shemaiah, the son of Mattaniah, the son of Micaiah, the son of Zachar, the son of Asaph. And there, blasting with all his might on one of the trumpets of God, was a son of Asaph to lead that procession on that day. And verse 36, with that man blasting on the trumpet, his brethren of the house of Asaph, Shemaiah and Azarel and Malali and Gilali and Maiah and Nethaneel and Judah and Hanani, with the musical instruments of David, the man of God, and Ezra, the scribe before them. What an august procession on this day. And I believe, brothers and sisters, I believe that verse 36 means exactly what it says. They had the musical instruments of David, the man of God. The very ones that David had made. Now you may have heard of the word either Stradivari or Guarneri or Guarnini, which are the three great violin-making families of Cremona in Italy. And if you buy a Stradivari, they're very expensive. They're normally at least in the region of $1 million and upwards, because why? They're over 300 years old. These men of the house of Asaph were singing on instruments that were over 500 years old. They had their own set of Stradivari. But these ones had been designed according to the pattern of Almighty God himself, and they had guarded and treasured and maintained and protected and preserved those instruments for over 500 years. And suddenly the ancient song of the house of Asaph reverberated all around the walls as they marched in procession, one company with the other, until finally they met together. And the record says in verse 42, at the end of the verse, "And the singers sang loud with Jezrahiah, their overseer." Do you know that's the only time in the Bible it ever says that the singers sang loud? The margin's correct, incidentally, made their voice to be heard. It's the word shema. They sang in such a way that their voice, their tune, their song, their words, their message would be heard on that day. They were filled with joy. And I think one of the reasons for that is because of the symbolism of what the wall represented. Because do you know, we're told, we won't turn it back, but in Nehemiah chapter 11, verse 1, we're told that when the wall was built, it says that they decided that they would bring others in to live in Jerusalem. But for the first time in the Bible, Jerusalem in Nehemiah chapter 11 verse 1 will be called finally the Holy City. Do you know why it's called the Holy City in Nehemiah 11 verse 1? Because now at last there is a wall right around the city to guard that. And inside that holy city was a holy temple which Zerubbabel had already built. And inside that holy temple was a holy place. And now that that wall was complete, within the guardianship of that wall and within the guardianship of the ancient benchmark of their family, this house, this family knew that spiritual life could flourish again in the nation. Oh yes, they sang loud on that day because of what that wall represented to them. Verse 45 says, "And both the singers and the porters kept the ward of their God and the ward of purification according to the commandment of David and of Solomon his son. For in the days of David and Asaph of old, there was a chief of the singers, and there were songs of praise and thanksgiving. And all Israel in the days of Zerubbabel and in the days of Nehemiah gave the portion of the singers and the porters every day his portion. And they sanctified holy things unto the Levites, and the Levites sanctified them unto the children of Aaron." And I think the implication, you see, of verse 46 is that just as in the days of old, David had appointed Asaph to be the chief of the singers, so now in the days of Nehemiah, there was another chief musician, the leader of the singers, just as it was in ancient times. Now, whether or not it was a member of the house of Asaph, we cannot be sure, but it's absolutely clear from the records of Ezra and Nehemiah that the house of Asaph was the dominant musical family. In fact, there's not a single reference in either Ezra or Nehemiah to Heman whatsoever. And there's one single reference only to a possible descendant of Jeduthun, but there are multiple references to the house of Asaph, the house of Asaph, the house of Asaph, the sons of Asaph in the book of Ezra and in the book of Nehemiah. Oh yes, they would be at the center of this re-flourishing of spiritual life and worship in the temple of Zerubbabel with the wall of guardianship all about it. And you know what's really sad about verse 46 of Nehemiah chapter 12? What's sad is that when you went into that holy city and then into that holy temple, and if you were to have gone into the most holy place, you would have found that there was no ark anymore. There was no priest with Urim and Thummim, no sacred fire, no Shekinah glory, and no Ark of the Presence to be seen. In fact, some of the historical writers tell us that there was a stone, just a stone in the most holy place, but I don't think there was. I think the stone that's being referred to in those writers is the actual stone of the foundation itself, because the most holy place was settled upon the stone. It's the very place where that little indentation has been discovered, where the Ark of the Covenant once rested, but it was just the bare rock itself. The Ark had gone. Do you think that changed the fervency of how this family sang? Not a bit. You see, they had long since transcended the idea of the physical ark and the importance of its presence. They drew close to God in song, even though the token of his presence was no longer there, and they sang in the days of Nehemiah with all the zeal with which they sang in the days of David, despite the fact that the Most Holy was empty and the ark of God had gone. For 550 years to this point of time, because that's where we are, you see, because when we come to this moment in Nehemiah's life, we're now BC 445. That's 90 years after the laying of the foundation in Ezra chapter 3. Another 90 years. Remarkable. That's another two or three generations from the ones who sang at the laying of the foundation in Ezra chapter 3. The singers that sing upon the wall in Nehemiah chapter 12 are again the grandsons of the previous story. It's just an astonishing story of a family that they never stop. They're just always there. It's a remarkable story in that sense. So we could say with absolute truthfulness, could we not, that this family were in particular two things, which perhaps really drove the selection of the title for this study, because they were at one and the same time a family of faith, were they not? They were there when David began this whole story. They were there when Solomon dedicated the temple. They were there when Jehoshaphat launched his spiritual revival and prayed in time of crisis. They were there when Joash was anointed as the boy king. They were there when Hezekiah cleansed the temple and sought to rededicate the nation. They were there when Josiah held his great Passover, the like of which had never been seen. They were there when Zerubbabel returned from the exile and laid the foundation of the house of God afresh. They were there when Nehemiah finished the wall and asked the singers to sing and inspire the nation yet again. They were there. They were always there. And they weren't just there, brothers and sisters. They were there at the very heart, the spiritual heart of the nation. Their spiritual influence was enormous. And all just because they knew how to sing their songs of praise. Oh yes, I think they were a family of faith, don't you? And if they were a family of faith, well, then we can also say that they were undoubtedly the masters of music. Because remember these benchmarks that became the basis for all that they did. Their music consistently promoted the supremacy of God. They emphasized the preeminence of principle. They maintained the solemnity of worship. They demanded the excellence of endeavor. And they proclaimed the virtue of constancy. And our music, our songs of praise, both with the words and the music, need to conform to these five guiding principles that the house of Asaph knew and loved so well. If we want to sing acceptably before God, we cannot imagine that the music we prefer or the words we like are necessarily either of them acceptable in heaven. What we sing and what the Father accepts may not be the same thing. And the one thing we know is that Yahweh heard the songs of this family. God delighted in the hymns of this family. This is the family that we need to learn from if we are to sing our own songs of praise acceptably before our Father in our own day and in our own generation. Their benchmarks. Without knowing a note or a tune of what they sang, we know what those tunes should sound like, in a sense, do we not? And we certainly know what the words should be like. That heritage is under threat in our community. It needs to be guarded. And we'll guard it best by knowing what it is that the benchmark was to begin with. When we don't know what the ancient landmarks are, we will abandon them. When we do, our very knowledge has brought us responsibility to guard them. So what was the secret, do you think, of this family? That's the burning question. How did they do it? How did they do this for 550 years? Well, I've got some thoughts, brothers and sisters, and I have to confess that even after the articulation of these thoughts, I'm still not really sure. There was something astonishing about this family that is almost, in a way, beyond comprehension, but I think here's some of the key things that contributed to the secret of their astonishing faithfulness down through time. Now, you'll know this first one. It's the first of Chronicles, chapter 16. We might just see how we go in terms of having a brief look at each of these passages. We're not going to spend a lot of time, but I just want to draw attention to one little idea out of each of these things. You see, they were thoroughly imbued with the spirit of God manifestation. Do you remember that idea in the first of Chronicles 16 and verses 8 to 11? Give thanks unto Yahweh, call upon his name, make known his deeds among the people. Sing unto him, sing psalms unto him, talk ye of all his wondrous works, glory ye in his holy name. Let the heart of them rejoice that seek Yahweh and his strength. Seek his face, seek his panim, seek his presence continually. You see, God manifestation was at the center of all this family did. Now the question is, how do we teach our children God manifestation? And the answer is not so much what we say, but what we do. Children will copy the lives of their parents. And if our lives are seen to be committed to the wonder of God's word, to the privilege of prayer, to the joy of solemn and biblical praise, to attendance at the meeting, to involvement in ecclesial activities, to commitment to his service, to the daily readings at home, to the giving of thanks for meals without fail, all those little things that are observed within a godly family, to attendance at Bible schools, children grow up accepting that that's normal, that that's the truth, that that's how it should be, that this must be what every family does. And when God manifestation is at the center of a family, there's an invisible lesson that children learn from the earliest age, and that's this, that somehow in this family, which you belong to as a child, this family revolves around the great center of God himself, and that gives purpose and meaning to all that our family does. And it's so easy, especially when we're young parents and delighted with the addition to our household, that somehow life revolves around the child. And without realizing it, we've shifted the center of gravity in that home, and we have not given the one precious gift that we ought to give our children, is that they grow up in a family where from their first moments of memory, all they can remember is that their family life has always revolved around the things of God. That's God manifestation at work in a family. That's the legacy we want to give to our children. We teach it by what we do. This family did. And here's the second thought. It's in Psalm 77, which is, of course, a psalm of the house of Asaph. We could have selected several such passages, but this one is typical, really, of the spirit of their psalms. And that's this, that this family were deeply aware, always aware, of the majesty of the divine presence. See what the record says in Psalm 77, and reading from verse 10. I said, this is my infirmity, but I will remember the years of the right hand of the Most High. I will remember the works of Yahweh. Surely I will remember thy wonders of old. I will meditate also of thy work and talk of thy doings. Thy way, O God, is in the sanctuary. Who is so great a God as our God? You see, this family lived in the Most Holy in their hearts. In their minds, they lived in the Most Holy. Wherever they were in God's presence. Now you see, the house of Asaph had obviously learned the principle of focus and concentration. And our singing needs to do the same. Our singing needs to take us into heaven, brothers and sisters. And to do that, mind has to grasp principle. And in order for mind to grasp principle, we need to understand, I suggest, the scriptural background to our hymns, so that when we open our hymn book, the testimony of the Bible leaps off the page, and we're taken back into the very circumstances through the language of the Spirit of where the psalm was born from, and now our emotions and our feelings are engaged because our spiritual minds have been enlightened. This family lived and breathed in the presence of God every day. I think that was part of their secret. That's truly how they felt. They were always conscious of the presence of God. And here's the third thing. They were committed to the standard of excellence of endeavor. Come and have a look at this in the First of Chronicles chapter 25. Just one word, actually. It's an old-fashioned word. It's a word that would be frowned on by modern educationalists. But it's what the house of Asaph did. And somehow it worked. And worked because of the principles by which they did it. First of Chronicles chapter 25 says, you remember these words, verse 7, so the number of them with their brethren that were instructed in the songs of Yahweh, even all that were cunning, were 208. And amongst all those cunning and instructed ones under the hands of Asaph their father, were these ones described as instructed in the songs. Now, you see that word instructed? That's the Hebrew word lamad, L-A-M-A-D. And Strong's has got a rather delightful definition of lamad. Strong says, it means to teach, and then in brackets he puts the words, the rod being an oriental incentive, close brackets. If you were a member of the house of Asaph, you knew from time to time, from rather sore knuckles, that you'd been instructed in the songs of God until you learnt not to get them wrong. But you learnt them all the same. And the spirit here was the spirit of excellence in endeavor in all that we do. See that word instructed in 1 Chronicles 25, verse 7? It's also translated as skillful in 1 Chronicles 5, verse 18. It's also translated as expert in Song of Solomon, chapter 3, verse 8. And the point is, they didn't become instructed, they didn't become skillful, and they didn't become expert by accident. They became it by dint of incessant endeavor. And you see, that spirit is not just a spirit that we should show in our singing. That spirit of excellence and endeavor is something that should pervade every aspect of our work in the life of the truth. That whatever we do is a burnt offering to God. And if it is, it needs to be offered to the very best of our ability until we're consumed in the joy of this service. And that striving lifts our praise to a new level. This family understood that. They practiced till they understood what they were singing. And the spirit, you see, is that endeavor alone brings satisfaction and joy because it's part of the excellence that we believe God deserves from us. God doesn't ask any one of us to give beyond what we're capable of. But he does ask that. That whatever we know we can do, to that level God expects excellence from each of us as an offering in his service. Here's another one. Do you remember this? 1 Chronicles chapter 23. Let's have a look at that. In the 1 Chronicles 23, the record says that they were involved in the principles of thanks and praise every day, you see. It says that, 1 Chronicles 23, verse 30, that the particular Levites whose role it was to sing, their role, it says, was to stand every morning to thank and praise Yahweh, and likewise at even. See, this was a daily task for this household. In fact, I think it's a bit of a key idea. You see, they were in that work day and night, says the 1 Chronicles 9. They did it as every day's work required, says 1 Chronicles 16. They were singing in chapter 23 here, every morning and likewise at even. And in Nehemiah 11, it says a certain portion should be for the singers, due for every day, because they sang every day. And we suddenly realize that this family, that was their daily routine. If you were to ask what really happened in the house of Asaph day by day, they got up, they had something to eat, they went to the temple and they sang the morning hymn. And when they sung the morning hymn, they came home and they practiced. And the middle afternoon, they went back to the temple and they sang the afternoon hymn at the time of the evening lamb. And then they came home and they had an evening meal and they went to bed. And then they got up and they had breakfast and they went to the temple and they sang the morning hymn. And then they came home and they practiced. And after they'd practiced, they went back in the afternoon to sing the afternoon hymn. And then they came home and they had an evening meal and they went to bed. And the next morning, they were every day involved. Their whole daily existence was centered on spiritual activity. And I think that was a key, one of the keys to their amazing faithfulness. Their lives never stopped doing anything other than revolving around the things of God. Oh yes, they were involved in these principles every day. And perhaps one of the blessings that belonged to this family for that reason is that we ought never to underestimate the corrosive power of daily contact with the world, such as it happens upon us. This family, because of their activities, were somewhat exempted from the damage that brings in the lives of the saints. And here's another one, and it's strongly related, is they were influenced by godly music to the heights of exaltation, spiritual exaltation. You remember what it said back in the record of 1 Chronicles? Actually, that should be 2 Chronicles. I instantly see the deliberate mistake. In 2 Chronicles chapter 5, which is of course the moment of the dedication of the temple in the days of Solomon, do you remember what it says in 2 Chronicles chapter 5? It said, verse 12, that all the Levites and singers were there. And then it says this in verse 13. It came to pass, as the trumpeters and singers were as one. Now, when it says that they were as one, it doesn't just mean that they were all singing together on that day because they were present. It doesn't mean they were all one because they were singing the same tune at the time from the same song. It means that when they sang, their hearts and minds were utterly united in the focus of what it was that they were offering to the Father at that particular moment. You see, the only music this family ever had was the music of the truth conducive to spiritual thoughts. That's the only music this family ever heard. And when they sang with one heart and one soul and one mind. Whoever the choir was, whoever the chorus was that assembled on that day, in a sense, there was only one voice that ascended to the Father on that day. Now you see, we need to never underestimate the power of music. Our homes ought to be sanctuaries for the things of the truth, including the music that's played in our homes. And we might play all sorts of different sorts of music. We're at liberty, we're at free will to choose whatever music that we would like in our homes. But the one golden rule that should apply in every spiritual home of every godly family is that whatever music is played, it ought never to be in any way detrimental to the spiritual objectives of good music. And the one thing that our musical taste should never do is give us a distaste of the hymns of worship which we sing. If that's the music that we listen to, then we ought to get rid of it. And parents in particular need to be fully aware of what their children are listening to, because music is one of the greatest powers for spiritual good and one of the greatest forces for spiritual destruction. And if we don't know what our children are listening to, then we should find out. I remember driving away from an ecclesial hall once, off to a family for a meal, some other part of the ecclesial world, and a young brother was going to take me. We left the meeting, hopped into his car, and the turning of the ignition key was the signal not only for the beginning of the motor, but for the beginning of the wailings of Baal. And within 2 minutes of leaving that ecclesial hall, such was the pounding beat of the car as we rocked down the road that the entire spiritual benefit of the memorial meeting was destroyed in 2 minutes. That's what music does. This family never knew anything other than godly music. I think that was one of the secrets to their faithfulness. It's the only music they ever permitted themselves to listen to. What would that do to our hearts and minds if we forbade ourselves access to every other type of music other than that which would engender in some way spirituality? Here's the rule. Studies have been done that shows that whatever music we develop a taste for during the ages of 15 to 25 will continue to have the greatest emotional effect on us for the rest of our lives. So you need to guard what your family are listening to in those critical years. It doesn't mean that they can't walk away from that music in the future. They might decide to actually abhor that which once they listened to, but if they ever hear it, They will instantly respond to it emotionally and physically for the rest of their lives. They'll never escape its power. Never again. Music is an astonishing power, either for good or for ill. You wouldn't catch the House of Asaph listening to the wrong stuff, brothers and sisters. They just wouldn't do it. And I think it was part of the key to their faithfulness. And here's the next thing, and you know this, but come to Psalm 78. Actually, I think Brother Dev referred to this in one of his classes earlier in the week. And it's a lovely thought, really, because you see what it says in Psalm 78 in verse 1. And you'll know these words. It says, "Give ear, O my people, to my law. Incline your ears to the words of my mouth. I will open my mouth in a parable. I will utter dark sayings of old, which we have heard and known, and our fathers have told us." And now he's going to recount this parable and dark sayings. Now, some of you may know that the word told in verse 3 is an interesting word because it's going to turn up three times in these opening verses of Psalm 78. It's the word told in verse 3. It's the same word in verse 4 translated as showing, and it's the same word in verse 6 translated as declare. It's the Hebrew word kaphar, C-A-P-H-A-R. And kaphar means as follows. It means to inscribe, to mark, to record, to recount, and to celebrate. So think of those words and apply that now to this particular Hebrew word in these verses. So I'm going to read these verses for you and just read the one translation of that word each time. In fact, I'm going to use the word inscribe. Think about that idea of inscribing upon the heart and mind. Now, let's read it again from verse 3. "Those things which we have heard and known, and our fathers have inscribed upon us, we will not hide those things from the children, inscribing upon the generation to come the praises of Yahweh and his strength and his wonderful works that he hath done." Verse 6, "so that that generation to come might know those things, even the children which should be born, who in turn would arise and inscribe them upon their children, that they might set their hope in God and not forget the works of God, but keep his commandments." You see, generation after generation of the family in this particular psalm were to have the praises of God and the principles of the truth inscribed upon their heart. Do you know why that's interesting? Because this psalm is a psalm of the house of Asaph. This was their family principle. This is what this family did concerning family instruction. This family were involved in continually teaching the next generation. And I think what happened, you see, in the house of Asaph, as each child came of age, they were pressed into the service of the songs of praise. And gradually they learned the songs, and then they learned the words, and then they learned the music, and then they learned the principles, and they learned the instrument. And while all that was happening in these families, what they were really doing is that the standards of the house of Asaph were being inscribed upon little hearts and little minds. And they grew up knowing nothing other than that is the way of God and the way of the truth. And I think what Psalm 78 is telling us, in a psalm actually written by a member of the house of Asaph, is that this, every generation of this family in particular, never missed a beat in doing that with their children. They never missed that responsibility. Oh yes, I think that's part of the key. They were inscribers of the passion of the truth to light the flame in the heart of the generation to come. All that we might capture the spirit of this family in that sense that they did so extraordinarily well. And here's the last thing. If you come back to Ezra chapter 3, I think this family, you see, were faithful in maintaining their standards with unswerving devotion. There was something absolutely, marvelously unchangeable in what this family did. And I think there's a lesson that comes out of that, you see, and that's this. Do you remember how it says in Ezra chapter 3 that when the builders laid the temple, the foundation of the temple, Ezra 3 verse 10, they set the Levites, the sons of Asaph, there with cymbals to praise Yahweh after the ordinance of David, the king of Israel. They sang together by course and praising and giving thanks to God. Now you see, the point of this episode in Ezra 3 is that when the sons of Asaph sang, they sang, it says, after the ordinance of David, king of Israel. And the thing is that they never once swerved aside from that. They sang David's songs to David's tunes, on David's instruments, to David's words, according to David's standards, the ordinance of David. They never deviated. Now, here's the point. Here's one of the lessons. You see, in every family, as children grow, there is tremendous pressure to change standards. Every set of parents knows this. As our children grow up, there is tremendous pressure to change our standards. Because the children are affected by all that goes on about them and by peer pressure, unfortunately, sometimes for bad, even within ecclesial life. So the message comes home that we ought to change. Why do we have to do this? And if at that critical moment, as parents, we do not know the principles that anchor our standards, you will compromise them. And the thing about this family is they knew not only what they did, but why they did it. And I'm sure there are moments in the story of the life of the house of Asaph when children said, why do we have to do this? And the answer came back, not only because Dad said so, which in the end is not a satisfactory answer, but because this is what the Bible says. And here's the divine principle enshrined in what our family does. They had the answers. They knew why what they did. Why what they did was so important. They were anchored in their standards, and that's why they were able to guard them. And when you think about it, you think about the remarkable spirit of Ezra chapter 3. You see, this one family, when you think about it, this one family was there when the foundation of Solomon's temple was laid. They were there when the foundation of that temple was destroyed and razed to the ground in the days of Nebuchadnezzar. And they were there when the foundation of Zerubbabel's temple was relaid in Ezra chapter 3. They'd seen it all, been through the whole thing. A foundation laid, a foundation destroyed, another foundation laid. They'd seen everything, this family. But the marvelous thing about this family is during all that time, the foundation of their own house had never, ever been changed in any way whatsoever. They knew what they stood for, and they understood the principles that were the foundation stones of what their family believed in and practiced every day of their lives. There's something powerful about that. We need to know what those are. So there were secrets in this family, weren't there? And I think perhaps it's the combination of those things, you see, that all worked somehow, their chemistry and their magic upon this family. It's all those things, all somehow woven together, don't you think? You know, it's interesting that there's a reference in the book of Maccabees, the first book of Maccabees, chapter 4, about a battle that occurred in the days of the Maccabees. Now we know that the book of Maccabees is not an inspired part of Scripture, but it is an historical account of that episode between the Old and New Testaments when the Jewish people fought against the Ptolemies and the Seleucids and sought to maintain their faith. The family of Maccabees was, of course, obviously critical to that story. And in one such episode, we read this in the first of Maccabees in chapter 4. It says that they rose up betimes in the morning and offered sacrifice according to the law upon the new altar of burnt offerings which they had made. In the same was it dedicated with songs. And then it says this, it says, and they sang upon harps and lutes, which we believe were psalteries and cymbals. And all the people fell upon their faces, worshipping and praising the God of heaven who had given them good success on that day. Where have we come across those three particular instruments before? What thinkest thou? These are the instruments that were known in the house of Asaph down through their successive generations, including the time when they stood on the wall in Nehemiah's day. They brought forth those instruments and walked around the wall praising God. And suddenly in the book of Maccabees, there's a reference to a battle, and it just says, almost by way of incidental allusion, and by the way, these were the three instruments that they had. Someone was there, the singers were there, praising at the good success of that moment in time. And you know what this particular record goes on to say in this chapter of Maccabees? It says, Judas returned to spoil the tents where they got much riches. They went home and they sung a song of thanksgiving. Ah, they sung a song of thanksgiving and they praised Yahweh in heaven. And thus Israel had a great deliverance on that day. Wouldn't it be lovely to know what song they sang, brothers and sisters, on that day? Well, we're told. It actually gives us the very words of the song that the singers sang on that day. Who do you think might have sung this song, brothers and sisters? The words of the song were, they praised Yahweh because he is good and because his mercy endureth forever. Ah, now, who might that have been singing that song on those instruments in the days of the Maccabees? I think there's every chance that just as there were zealous Maccabees, so were their faithful singers who had guarded the truth of their family for generations yet to come. And if that's true, do you know when that is? After Nehemiah? You may not be able to see the bottom of the screen, but I'll read it to you. That moment in time is BC 160 in the days of Judas Maccabeus, 285 years after Nehemiah chapter 12. Another 285 years after the sons of Asaph walked upon the wall in Nehemiah chapter 12. If that be the case, brothers and sisters, then we have here truly the most astonishing family that Israel has ever seen with regard to the spirit of their faithfulness. The like of which we will probably never see again. And that's really, in a sense, where we conclude, isn't it? Because, you see, what was their secret? Was it all those things? The God manifestation, singing songs every day, the standard of excellence, inculcating it into the next generation? I know that it was all those things, but I think the real secret was that the house of Asaph didn't just talk about this, they did it. Sometimes we talk about these things, but it's the practice of them. The secret in this family lay that they practiced these things every day. And even then, I have to say that I do not really understand the fullness of the secret of this particular family. I love the house of Asaph. I love Asaph. He's one of my personal heroes. I love him for what he stood for. I love him for what he did to light the flame that would burn for generation after generation in his own family. I love them because of what they guarded. I love them for how they sang. I love them for their spirit of fervent zeal in worshiping God in spirit and in truth. And whether we will ever understand the fullness of their secret, perhaps we never will. But we can try. We can try and at least learn some of the principles of that story and try and build families in our own day that remain strong in the truth for our own time and possibly in the generation to come, if God gives us strength to light that flame in the next generation, we shall have at least captured a measure of the spirit of this family. You know, it's one of those things, isn't it, in the divine record where sometimes in the midst of such a study, when your heart has been focused on those words and those ideas and those thoughts, and because you're tuned into the frequency of the story of the house of Asaph, something else jumps off a page, and when you see it, you see it. And such a passage is Jeremiah chapter 33, with which we shall close. Because what a suitable and appropriate thought with which to close our consideration of this remarkable family with whom we have journeyed in these few moments at our Bible school. See, Jeremiah 33 says in verse 7, there's the promise of a return from the captivity. And there was an initial fulfillment in the days of Zerubbabel and Ezra, There was a return of the captivity, but in the fullness it can't have been all that Jeremiah promised, because Jeremiah 33 verse 7 says, I will cause the captivity of Judah and the captivity of Israel to return, and will build them as at the first, and will cleanse them from all their iniquity. No, the fullness of the promise of Jeremiah is of a return from the captivity that involves both the households of the family of Israel and Judah. And when that day, that wondrous day comes, says the record in Jeremiah 33, verse 10, there shall be heard in this place, which ye say shall be desolate, without man, without beast, even in the cities of Judah, in the streets of Jerusalem, that are desolate, without man, without inhabitant, without beast. At last, again, comes the cry of the prophet in promise and assurance. There will be heard yet again the voice of joy and the voice of gladness, the voice of the bridegroom and the voice of the bride, and the voice of them that shall say, praise Yahweh of armies, for Yahweh is good, for his mercy endureth forever. Yes, the voice of the sacrifice of praise, the voice of them that shall bring that sacrifice into the house of Yahweh, says the prophet Jeremiah, shall yet be heard again in this city and in this place, comes the promise of God. And I think that hidden in the promise of Jeremiah 33 and verse 11 is the promise that when the kingdom age is restored, that amongst the mortal Levites that will do service in the house of God, there will be a particular family that will stand again and sing their hymn. And we'll be privileged to hear them. And the legend of the faithfulness of the house of Asaph will be recounted in the kingdom to the mortals. It's an example of what it means to be faithful before God in all their generations. Let's be thankful, brothers and sisters, for the wonder of such a story. May our hearts and minds be lifted and exalted to likewise in our own days seek to worship him with all the passion and fervency and zeal of this family, whose privilege can be ours if we learn the secret of their lives.